The Ohio House finalized its version of the state budget last week. Will the Senate follow House Republicans' lead when it comes to property tax relief, school funding, and more? You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Also this hour in the weekly news review, a local man detained by ICE and held in Butler County, and student visas revoked across Ohio. Plus, new details emerge on the sudden closure of a Cincinnati charter school. Here to kick off this week's news review are Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Anna Staver and Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Anna and Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, the Ohio Senate has taken up the budget this week. The version the Ohio House passed has a new provision that affects how schools accommodate religious-based programs. Wasn't that something decided last year?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, I'm talking to you, Joe. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it was something that was sort of decided last year. It's pieces of it, but this budget actually takes it a step further. And there are parts of this budget that make it so that private schools would have to comply with DEI measures. And that's something kind of new because Senate Bill 1 passed earlier this year. And then there are changes in the structure of the schools and, like governance, that kind of thing that goes along with that, too.
And can you talk a little bit more about these programs? What kind of programs are we talking about, these religious-based programs?
Well, the religious-based, I think you're talking about the religious-based release time for religious instruction. I think that's what you're talking about,
exactly.
Right?
Oh, yep.
Okay, we're on the same page now. I was a little confused there. So it's a Friday, right?
Yeah, it's a Friday.
Yeah. So last year, it was passed, this release time for religious instruction, and that allows schools like LifeWise, that's the biggest one in Ohio, that allows them to come in on school time and take kids out with parent permission during non-core classes, kind of like music or phys ed or, study hall or whatever. And so that's been going on for a while. But right now, there are a couple things happening. One thing is in the budget, they're trying to lay down some limits, like how long a student can go, how often a student can go to those kind of things. And then also, there's a push right now to try to expand that and kind of make sure that, when they allowed these school districts to come up with rules, the school district could set the rule that they wanted for it. And now the religious instruction folks, LifeWise, they're saying, wait a minute, you're not allowing us to let the kids come in with candy or religious, books or whatever it is. In some of these school districts, you're putting hurdles there so that we can't operate the way that we want to operate anymore. So they're really pushing back on these school districts and saying, hey, if you don't go ahead and allow us to bring these things in, these goodies that bring those in with the kids, we're going to sue. Of course, the schools are saying that all of that disrupts things in the school when you've got some kids who have candy, others that don't, you have, a lot of disruption. So that's the ongoing battle right now.
Okay. So the people who are concerned about the candy and things, they're saying, okay, the absence for religious instruction is one thing, but when the kids come back with candy and books and goodies, that's disruptive and distracts the other kids. Is that kind of the objection there?
That's kind of the objection. And the other thing is that, it was pointed out to me by the opponents that when they passed release time for religious instruction, it was not supposed to involve any of the school personnel to facilitate any of it. It was just send them off. They're saying that when they come back with, some of these things, that it causes, disruption in the classroom, which the teachers have to deal with. But also there's the issue of what if they send back a candy bar that has nuts in it, and you've got a kid who has a nut allergy in that classroom, and there's a problem. The teacher is definitely on the ground and then dealing with that. And then who has the liability for that in addition? So there seems to be kind of an impasse as to how this can be implemented. And LifeWise wants that part of it removed, saying that that's their right to religious expression to be able to do that. But some schools are not buying it. So that's where we are.
Okay. Have the school districts responded in any way to just the missing of class time? If students are excused for a little while for LifeWise or these other programs, what do they think of students just being gone from class for that time?
Well, some school districts don't. I mean, some school districts have actually banned this, release time for religious instruction. They banned it last year before this bill passed for those very reasons. They said, well, you know, the kids go out. It's hard to get them back in here. And, you know, if you've ever, you know, been around 30 kids trying to get them or 25 kids trying to get them on the same page to do anything, sometimes that's a challenge for teachers. So there were some schools that initially had kind of banned LifeWise from going in. Then you have this rule that came, this law that came in effect at the end of last year. So they actually had to put into place policies to allow it. But now LifeWise is saying that those policies are so strict that they can't operate in some of those school districts. And I think there's some school districts that would just love the idea of not having to deal with it.
Well, Joe, I want to talk to you about another part of the budget, too, and that is Governor DeWine's version of the 2-year budget included a child tax credit provision. Talk to us about his plan, what he wanted to see in there.
Well, he wanted to see this child tax credit for families, you know, especially working families, you know, to make sure that they had what they needed, money to raise a kid, because he says it's really expensive. And so this would have been a full out tax credit that would have been given to them. But when it went over to the and it would have been funded with sin taxes. But when it went over to the House, they tore out that. They tore out a lot of the provisions that DeWine had put into this budget, in his budget, and they tore those out, and the child care credit is no longer in there. However, the governor, when you talk to him about, you know, is this a done deal? He says no. He says he's working with the Senate to try to get it back in. The question is, will the Senate put it back in, and will they find money to pay for it? And where will that money come from? Because the House has been pretty clear that it doesn't want any sin taxes. It doesn't want any extra fees, taxes to go for these kind of things.
Okay. Well, Anna, let's get you into this conversation. House Republicans also have a property tax relief plan that's part of their budget proposal. It's tied to school district savings accounts. How does that work?
Yeah, so the House Republicans say that this could be an up to $4 billion tax return for Ohio. And so, I mean, they're touting it as the largest property tax relief bill ever. And arguably, it would be true, but there's a big asterisk on that. So school districts have savings accounts, like you or I have savings accounts. And the Ohio legislature says they shouldn't be piggy banks. So they don't want schools to keep more than 30% of their annual operating budget in a savings account. And some districts have 60, 80. I think there's a district that has almost 140% of its operating budget in savings. So the way this would work is you wouldn't actually get a check. You would get a discount on your property taxes for schools, and that would start in January of 2027. So that bill would be reduced by whatever amount the district has above that 30%. Now, the catch here is that the school districts could spend that money, right? So some districts say, look, we use our general fund to save to build a new high school. That's what Athens City Schools told me. So they were like, yeah, we're above it, but we actually just went below that 30% because we moved $7 million over to build this new high school. So school districts could move the money, they could spend the money, and then you as a taxpayer wouldn't get it back. And it would also depend. So like Cincinnati Public Schools does not have a big savings account. So those people wouldn't see any change in their taxes. Whereas like Columbus does have a big savings account. So those people potentially could save a couple $100 on their property taxes.
Why do some of these school districts have so much money in these carryover balances in these savings accounts?
Yeah, so it depends. So like I said, Athens, for example, said the general fund is where they save up money for construction projects. So, and a lot of school districts say this, they save this money in their savings account to then do construction. Now, Republicans will say you can put money into dedicated construction accounts that wouldn't be touched by this. So it would just be a shifting of where you save it. The other thing that school districts say that's really interesting is, and I don't want to get too in the weeds here for folks, but we have a rule when you pass a levy that it can't collect more than it originally collected. So if your home value goes up, it can't. You actually might not see an increase on that levy, if that makes sense, because as a whole, from the whole district, it can't collect more than it originally. So if they ask for $1 million, they can only ever collect $1 million. So when school districts pass levies, sometimes they ask for more than they need, knowing that inflation will take a cut over time. Does that make sense? And yeah, so then when they ask for this, they have a lot of money at the beginning of the levy, but the idea is over the life of that levy, it's diminishing returns, right? They're going to get less and less and less because we all know, eggs and everything are getting more expensive. So they plan to use that money throughout the life of the levy. And so at the very beginning of passing one, they look a lot wealthier.
They look like they're flush with cash, but it doesn't go the whole life of the levy. What do school districts say this would mean for property tax levies if this were to become law?
So there's a couple of different concerns. One concern is that they would have to, you could just move money, say, to construction fund if it was construction fund. But with this, we have a bunch of money from a new levy question. It gets more complicated. There was one lawmaker who described it as incentivizing districts to spend money like drunken sailors to get ahead of the budget going into effect. The other real question is, so this would be a discount on 2027. And I am a math nerd, so I ran the numbers. For me, I live in a high tax school district in suburban Columbus, and it would take about $1,900 off my property taxes in 2027. So that's not nothing to sneeze at.
$1,900. Yeah, wow.
My school district has a really big savings account. So if they didn't move the money, if they didn't spend the money, then that's what would come back to me. But in 2028, my property taxes would go right back up. Right? Like once that was paid off, then it would go back up. So this would be temporary. This would be like a 1 year dip. And so there's a question about whether we should do this or we should actually work to create like long-term changes to property taxes.
What has the governor said about this idea?
He's been pretty careful. He's usually pretty careful before things get to him. One of the other ideas, there's like a dozen property tax reform bills floating around the legislature right now. And he's very, at least in conversations that I've had or in gaggles, like he's taking a really wait and see approach to see like what actually comes to him at the end.
Anna, you also reported on this proposal for about this proposed legislation related to property tax breaks and the influence school districts have over those. What's that about?
Oh, yeah. So I love a good property tax story, but somebody has to. But so when you are, so there's these things called CRAs, and all you need to know is like if there's an area where your city wants to incentivize development, they can say, hey, those properties, those homes being built in this area won't pay property taxes for like a decade. And so it makes the homes more affordable, right? Because you don't have to pay property taxes, but it also might incentivize somebody to buy in, say, a not so nice area, right? The whole idea is this is a place where they want to encourage development. Maybe it's not the best neighborhood. And so they offer this like tax-free status for these homes. But the flip side of that is if you put, say, 30 or 40 homes in an area, those are potentially 30 or 40 sets of children going to a school district, and they're not going to pay, their parents aren't paying property taxes for a decade. So you increase the cost of the school district without giving them any more money. And so there's a question about whether school districts should have to sign off on these abatements. So it's really a question of like, should you cover the tax bill for your new neighbor?
Interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. Joe, I want to come back to you. House Republicans have proposed legislation to allow nine historic documents or some of nine historic documents to be displayed in schools. What's that about?
Well, that's a bill that it's the historic documents bill that would allow like things like the Constitution. I think the Declaration of Independence is on there, the Mayflower Compact, things like that, the Bill of Rights, that's on there. But it also allows, as you said, it allows the Ten Commandments. And the idea is that these are founding documents, according to the sponsor, that should be on the walls in schools across the state. There are questions, as you can imagine, about putting the Ten Commandments on the walls because that is not normally considered a historic document by American historians. They consider more like the other things that are more part of American culture, and they consider that a religious document. However, the sponsors of this point out that some of the drafters of the Constitution were indeed, following the Ten Commandments. So it's going back and forth. We've seen this in other states that have required the Ten Commandments be put in the schools. There have been lawsuits about it. It's probably going to, at some point, someone's going to end up at the U.S. Supreme Court dealing with this issue because it just keeps getting passed in different places, and then you have lawsuits. So that's kind of where we are with this.
Yeah. Well, Anna, speaking of lawsuits, this week a judge struck down a social media law in Ohio that required parental consent for users under the age of 16. Tell us what that ruling was about.
Yeah, so this has been happening across the country. There is this real question about how teens access social media sites like TikTok, Instagram. They don't really use Facebook. That's more of an old folks social media now. But it is a question of how minors access these sites, how much their parents actually know about what they're accessing, and what responsibility, if any, the companies themselves should have for this. So, the first way that Ohio and a bunch of other states went about this was to say the onus is on the company. So, it's on Meta, it's on TikTok, it's on any Snapchat to basically verify the age of their users. And that could be as simple as like taking a picture of your driver's license to prove that you're an adult, because you right now when you sign up you tell it how old you are, but you can absolutely lie about that fact. And so the companies sued, saying like this was a violation of their constitutional rights, and this was complicated. And some of these laws, like Utah's, went even further and wanted teens to not be able to access social media sites after a curfew of like 10 p.m. And so the federal courts have almost universally said, like, states, you cannot do this. So now they're trying a different tack, which is to go through the app stores. So that's like Apple, App Store, if you have an iPhone, or Google, if you have an Android. And they're basically saying the app stores need to verify the age of the person who uses the phone. So it's a one stop. And then, so I'm a parent, I have daughters. And so essentially how it would work was, maybe when I go and buy them a phone, we haven't gotten there yet, but when we get there with my kids, like we would go buy them a phone, I would set it that this is my daughter's birthday. And then the app store itself would ping me or alert me when she's trying to download certain things. And then I would have to give permission. And they think that this might be a more constitutional, a more legal route of, and it's also, they're making the argument that it would be easier, right? The app store only has to do it once. You could probably do it like at Verizon when you're buying the phone for your kid. And then you would just get to decide, okay, she can have this app, she cannot have that one.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Engels, and Cleveland.com State House reporter Anna Staver. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Up next, the impact of Trump administration policies on students at Ohio universities and an immigrant in Butler County. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Dozens of international students at Ohio universities have lost their visas, and the detention of an immigrant in Butler County has drawn protests from members of a local church. Join me now to discuss how these Trump administration policies are playing out in Ohio are Cleveland.com politics and policy reporter Laura Hancock. Thanks for being here, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And WCPO9 multimedia journalist Jay Shakur. Welcome back, Jay.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Laura, let's start with you. What can you tell us about international students at Ohio universities who've lost their visas? How many students are we talking about?
We're at least 56. It seems like every few days we hear about more. And these are at both private schools such as Xavier and public schools such as the University of Cincinnati. They're statewide. I mean, you're seeing people at Kent State, which now has 10. The largest that we know of is Youngstown State University. 14 students have lost their visa status. Ohio State is at 12 now.
Do we know the reasons why these students lost their visa status?
We don't know every situation, but we know in general, having spoke to immigration attorneys who are representing the students or representing other students who are afraid that they're going to get deported, that a lot of this has to do with their views in support of Gaza in the Gaza war. And so a lot of them feel that, and the established law says you have a First Amendment right, even if you are an immigrant to the United States. So, but, you know, under the Trump administration, they just don't feel the same way, and they are revoking visas for these students.
You mentioned Xavier University and the University of Cincinnati. Those two institutions have a small number of students who have lost their visas. What have you heard from Xavier and UC?
I haven't heard from the University of Cincinnati. I never heard from the school directly. However, the President Pinto did put up a letter to the university community explaining this, acknowledging kind of how upsetting it is for people who are friends and professors of the students, offering support services for the students. Cincinnati has only said, University of Cincinnati has only said a small number. They haven't given us any like real specifics. Xavier has said at least one, and the members of Xavier's International Student and Scholars Services office is doing outreach for the student or students and continues to try to support them in navigating the situation. The schools in general, from all the ones that have talked to me, they don't know beforehand if somebody is about to lose their visa. What they have to do is go check every day a government database it's a government database for these students, and just basically run names. And if a name isn't on there, that means that they lost their visa status. And schools are not told any why. So a lot of this could be a mystery. Like, we don't know all the cases.
So that's how the schools are finding out. Are students notified directly?
Yeah, the students are notified. I don't know. I mean, there have been situations like Kent State University, for instance. They have sent out, you know, told students and faculty, if you are approached on campus, this is what you do. But they haven't had instances of that. So we don't know if students, we don't know how they're finding out. Are they getting arrested in a traffic stop? If they're getting an email asking them to self-deport? We don't know the details quite yet.
Obviously, a lot of Ohio universities have international students, work to attract international students. Do you have a sense for what the broader implications could be for universities who really work to cater to international students?
Well, at the very basic level, you're talking about people who pay full tuition. Students who are residents of Ohio are not paying the full tuition because the idea is the state legislature is helping to subsidize that. Out-of-state students get an out-of-state student rate. When you are an international student, you're paying quite a bit more. Schools really do depend on this income to be able to make the doors, you know, make the the classes go, make keep the electricity on, that kind of thing. So it is a financial loss for the schools. But then there's a larger loss. You know, probably a lot of us who went to college remember times when we were having a classroom discussion and somebody who is from a different country said something that just kind of shook you to your core, like, whoa, you know, because you get stuck in your ways and you're an American and you know how this system works and you don't think about other things and other parts of the world. So this is, you know, having these students there is good for everyone's education. And then at the larger level, a lot of these students do eventually become American citizens and they work for United States companies. And the ones who are especially like in medical and technical fields, I mean, we are talking people being deported who could have maybe one day found an immunotherapy for cancer or, you know, helped work on a new technology. And so from that perspective, this is a loss. Now, Trump is taking the more law and order perspective, saying, well, these people should not be here. They're breaking the law. However, the immigration attorneys are always saying, like, if you're really looking for the lawbreakers, this student group isn't really who you need to be worried about. There's other people who maybe have, you know, other crimes and other things that they could have done. And this is just kind of an easy way for the Trump administration to say they're doing something about immigration. So that's kind of the overall.
Yeah. Well, that talk of law and order brings me to you, Jay. Talk about what happened to Armando Reyes Rodriguez.
He is a most recent case of that hammer of law and order coming down here, particularly in Butler County. We believe he's from Honduras. We got that information from his pastor. Haven't been able to speak directly to his family yet, but we believe he is from Honduras. It's unclear how many years, but he's been in the U.S. for at least more than 3 years, has a family, has children in the Dayton area, and he attended a church. The church is the West Charleston Church of the Brethren near Tip City, very active in his church. And he went in Monday, according to his pastor and members of his church and community, he went in Monday to an ICE appointment. They told him to come in, and he was under the impression, according to church members, that he was just getting an ankle monitor removed. Now, we hear ankle monitor, we think that means you committed a crime. That's not necessarily the case. ICE uses an ankle monitor at times to monitor people in the country illegally. It's an alternative to, you know, a detention facility. He thought he was getting that removed. Him and his wife, they've been seeking asylum for a few years now here in the United States. And he went in with the co-pastor of his church and he didn't come out. Instead, he ended up detained at the Butler County Jail.
Yeah. I know you talked with people who protested his detention or who were protesting his detention. What did they tell you?
They were shocked. They felt they used the term deceptive detention. They felt that he was following all the rules. Exact quote, he was doing everything right. He was going to all of his appointments. He was doing everything he knew to do to legally seek asylum. And he was, as they say, their words, deceptively detained. So they're frustrated. They're angry. They were out there Monday, the day he was detained, and they were out there again Wednesday. And we're told that they will periodically be out there over and over again to demonstrate, to bring attention to his story, because they feel he was an example of a model. That's another term they use, model migrant, that was doing everything they could to be a part of the United States of America. Mm.
And again, just circling back to that ankle monitor, it sounds like we don't know exactly why he was wearing that, but there are lots of different reasons that ICE uses those.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
We don't know exactly why. Yeah, that's still unclear.
Yeah. Well, I know Butler County Sheriff Richard Jones, he's been on this program talking about immigration. He's been very supportive of President Trump's immigration policies. Did the sheriff talk with you at all about this case?
No, he did not talk specifically about this case. We requested interviews and everything, but did not talk to us directly about this particular case. But as you mentioned, he's very adamant about aiding and being supportive of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. In fact, he recently applied for and received authority to not only detain, but also given, you know, the contract that they have with ICE, can interrogate, transfer, even prepare processing and charging documents for ICE arrestees, I should say. He's very, very aggressive in his support of aiding the administration and their immigration crackdown efforts.
You mentioned that the pastor of this man who's being detained, his fellow parishioners are all supportive. Any idea what's next with him, or is that all unclear too?
That is also unclear. That's some of the clarity we're hoping to get from the sheriff in terms of what's next. Why exactly was he detained on this particular date? That's still unclear. So what's next for him? We don't know. Logically, there will be some type of hearing, but we exactly unsure exactly when that will be and what will, you know, the contents of that be. Still a lot of uncertainty. That's really the through line of the story. A lot of uncertainty of why this particular person was detained at the particular moment they were, and then what's next for them? Will they just sit there in the Butler County Jail? Will they be transferred, or will they ultimately be deported, which will then separate a father from his wife and children?
Well, we appreciate your reporting. I've been talking with Cleveland.com politics and policy reporter Laura Hancock and WCPO9 multimedia journalist Jay Shakur. Thank you both so much for your time today and for your work.
Thank you.
Up next, more details emerge over the sudden closure of a Cincinnati charter school. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Doane Community High School closed abruptly last month, leaving hundreds of students scrambling to enroll elsewhere to continue their education. Now, new details about the school's financial troubles have emerged. Joining me now to explain is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. So Doane Community High School permanently closed on March 31st. What have you learned about the financial state of the school?
Well, I've learned that they're at least $1.8 million in debt, according to a recent court filing. And there is a lawsuit pending that could increase that total to the tune of more than $1 million. So they're not in good shape. And they went from being a school with $4 million in cash at the end of their 2023 fiscal year, that's June of 2023, to less than or a negative amount of $238,000 in their cash balance in June of 2024.
And this is a charter school, right?
It is a charter school, yes.
Do we know how many students the school claims were enrolled and if those numbers are accurate?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because some of the filings that we reviewed indicated that Don's administrator, who ran the school through a contract with his for-profit management company, it's called the Cincinnati Charter School Collaborative, and his name is Ramon Davenport. And so according to recent filings, Davenport was claiming to the state that they had 1,600 students, but by the time they closed, they were down to about 600.
And this school had a pretty specialized program. Explain what the focus of it was and the kinds of students it served.
Yeah, they call it the School of Second Chances because it's known as a dropout recovery school. And, you know, they say that they've had everybody from kids experiencing homelessness to, you know, single parents to people that just dropped out of other schools and couldn't find their way in traditional public schools. And so they really did have this mission of helping people get their high school diploma. And they were targeting students age 16 and over. They had a 22 plus program where adults could go back and try to get their degree or their high school diploma, you know, from a school as opposed to getting a GED. And they had some success early on, as recently as 2015. Davenport was a finalist for a statewide award by a charter group, alliance, a charter group association. And so he was fairly lauded for his success. He did grow enrollment, expanded the number of sites where they offered classes, and he had some innovative programs that allowed students to have a flexible schedule and do a lot of their coursework and testing online. And so, you know, they had a lot of things going for it, and the demise really came as a disappointment to parents and students who like that approach.
Such important work too to help students who are looking to complete their educations in that way. You
Right.
mentioned Mr. Davenport, the former head of the school, and I understand he's under investigation. Tell us why.
Well, what we know is that the Buckeye Community Hope Foundation, that is the Don School's sponsor, they're the ones that contract with the school, and they're kind of like the go-between between state funding and the school itself. And so they came out in June with a letter to the state auditor, where they questioned outrageous spending in the 2024 fiscal year, and they raised some questions about vendors that were doing business with Don, including the Collaborative and another gentleman by the name of Larry Ballou. And he owns two companies that, according to tax records and some of the court filings we reviewed, these two companies received more than $5 million in funding from the Don Community High School since 2018, including about 2.8 million in the 2024 fiscal year.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
It is.
Yeah. And was any of that money, I guess I want to come back to this notion of enrollment. Was any of that money based on enrollment? Because I think you said earlier that some of the documentation claimed 1,600 students, others said 600. I mean, is that an issue in other charter schools in terms of enrollment numbers and that sort of thing?
Their revenue is based on enrollment, and that is a thing that we've not really looked into, and we didn't see much discussion of it in the court records and in the documents that were attached to it. But yeah, both the school has its funding based on the number of students, and then the Buckeye Community Hope Foundation generates a fee off of that revenue, and so did the Collaborative. So Davenport's fees came from, you know, the enrollment number that he was reporting to the state.
Kind of like a commission system almost.
Yeah, I think I, well, I shouldn't speak out of turn. I believe the percentage at the end was 6% of the total revenue from the school. His fee was based on that.
I see.
Yeah.
This is such a complicated story. There are so many moving parts here. Does this point to any concerns about how charter schools are regulated in Ohio? Are cases like these leading to any changes in oversight?
I haven't heard of any changes in oversight, but there is a group that thinks they're needed, and that's the Network for Public Education. And they're a nonprofit that advocates for investments in public schools, and they also are a well-known critic of charter schools or community schools, as they're known in Ohio and in other states. And, you know, basically what Carol Burris, the executive director of this group, said was that what happened here could not happen in a public district, because school superintendents have to rely on competitive bidding in order to choose vendors. And an expert with the Ohio Ethics Commission told me that superintendents also have to submit financial, you know, disclosure documents. They have to say what companies they do business with, or that they own a piece of. And that is not the case for charter schools. And so, in Burris's opinion, Ohio has a very loose charter system that she says is an invitation to fraud.
You referenced a couple minutes ago this connection between Mr. Davenport and Mr. Ballou. Your report really digs into that financial connection. Can you talk a little bit more about that connection and this company that's involved that did work for the school?
Sure. We found a number of connections, and we're still learning about more. But essentially, the biggest connection is that Ballou's companies had this, you know, vendor relationship with the Don Community School. And then we also learned that one of Ballou's companies, a company called Core Educational Services, provided a loan to Davenport, and he pledged a home as collateral for that loan in December of 2023. And incidentally, that home was sold this week, and the loan was released by Ballou. And so, you know, what to make of that, we're not sure, but it is evidence that in the same year that Core Educational Services got $1.8 million from the Don Community High School, Davenport got a $500,000 loan from Ballou.
Have either of those men talked with you in your reporting?
I spoke briefly to Mr. Ballou, who we didn't really discuss the loan because I was still working on details related to it at the time. He said that that he was not an owner of the collaborative, and he didn't have any management role in the collaborative. That was something that was raised by the Buckeye Foundation. You know, they suspected that Ballou actually was a partner of Davenport's in the collaborative, and we couldn't find evidence of that, and Ballou specifically denied that in the conversation that I had with him. Then I went back to Mr. Ballou to try to ask him additional questions, and he hasn't returned my call.
And Mr. Davenport, has he been willing to speak to you?
I was unable to find him at, I've used some email addresses that I think are still active for him. The phone number that I had for him is no longer his. And so, yeah, I've been trying to reach him, but haven't been able to do so.
You mentioned talking with the Ohio Ethics Commission earlier. Is there a law against what these men are being accused of doing in these court filings?
Well, there is a state law that says you can't award contract. If you're a public official, you can't award contracts to a business associate. And that's a pretty broad statement. And it would require a lot of detail that we don't currently have to know if that's what happened here. As I was talking to Paul Nick, the executive director of the Ethics Commission, you know, he said that you know, there are examples. Well, for example, the loan, he said that's not necessarily an example of a business relationship. There's another example of a bar, or a restaurant that that Ballou and Davenport established. They filed paperwork with the state to create a limited liability company for this restaurant, which is on East McMillan. And their names are both on the document, but that's not an indication that they are owners of the business. And it's really not clear whether they're, you know, managers or operators of the business. All it indicates is that they were the people who filed the paperwork to create the limited liability company. One as a statutory agent, which is the person who accepts legal documents on behalf of the company. And then the other one is the actual organizer of the company, which can be an owner, but it could also be just somebody authorized to file the paperwork. So in order to really know whether they were business associates or the extent to which their business relationships guided, you know, their contracting between Don and the and the two companies owned by Mr. Ballou, you've got to really look at financial records. You have to understand where the money is flowing. You have to have a witness who says, yes, there is a business relationship and here's how it exists. And so it's pretty early in the investigation. And so far what we've focused on, and I'm not sure how far advanced the Ohio's auditor's office is, but so far what we've focused on is what's the documentary evidence that there is some kind of a business relationship here.
This school had announced earlier this year that it would close at the end of the school year. Why did it close so suddenly instead? Was it because of this mounting financial trouble?
Yes. Initially, they were thinking that they would be able to make it through the end of the school year. And then, you know, if you reading through the documents between June and September, the Buckeye Foundation was finding more and more details out about the financial shape of the school and the relationship between Ballou and Davenport. And in late September, they gave the school board evidence, Don's, you know, board of governors. They gave them evidence that Davenport and Ballou did actually have a business relationship. And shortly after that is when they terminated the contract with the collaborative. And then following that, the board tried to make a deal and did actually make a deal to sell two of their buildings. And part of that deal with a Columbus company called Performance Academies, another charter school, was going to buy these two schools and open up a K through 8 program.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Dan. I'm going to tell everybody to read your story on WCPO.com to get the details. I've been talking with WCPO 9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Lucy May.